Good day. It's Monday, January 6th. This is the NPR News Update. I'm Phil Picardi. Coming up, a longtime Minnesota lawmaker is remembered for his moderation. The state weighs in on wild rice, and vegetable and animal waste turn the lights on in Le Sueur. First, extra police officers patrolled the streets this morning to make sure no school children were waiting in the cold for a school bus. School is canceled statewide due to the extremely cold weather. Governor Dayton announced the decision on Friday, and districts also tried to spread that message far and wide over the weekend. Education Commissioner Brenda Caselius says it's an unusual situation for families, and businesses are doing their part to make it work.
Businesses have been just terrific stepping up and having employees either be able to take the day off or work at home, or they've closed themselves. So we think this is very, very serious, and children need to stay home, stay inside, and stay warm.
Temperatures are expected to be a bit warmer tomorrow, but they're not really going to reach normal levels for this time of the year, at least average levels, until the end of the week. Family members say Minneapolis Mayor R.T. Ryback is in good spirits after suffering a heart attack Saturday. Martin Moylan reports.
One of Ryback's physicians told a news conference there is damage to Ryback's heart, but the extent is still unclear. Ryback's daughter, Grace, says her 58-year-old father was quite animated less than 24 hours after he felt chest pain and was short of breath while cross-country skiing.
He's looking so much healthier already. He's talking and laughing and visiting with family and friends.
She says her dad was fortunate.
He got back to his car and called my mom, and when he still was feeling short of breath, his friends happened to come across him in his car, and in talking with him, it became clear that he wasn't doing well, so he asked them to call 911. He was skiing by himself, which is why we're so grateful that his friends happened to be there to help him out.
Physicians at Abbott Northwestern performed an angioplasty and implanted stents to restore blood flow. Ryback is expected out of the hospital by midweek. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Former Speaker of the Minnesota House, Rod Searle, has passed away at the age of 93. Searle served the House for 24 years, representing Waseca. He was a moderate Republican who became Speaker in 1979. The House was evenly split between Republicans and Democrats that year, and Searle was a compromise selection. He did not seek re-election after the 1980 session. Republican Jim Uhland served in the legislature with Searle for a number of years and later became Commerce Commissioner. He talked today with Kathy Werzer.
Well, what were Speaker Searle's strengths as a lawmaker? I'm curious.
Well, the interesting thing about Rod Searle was he was a moderate Republican. In the House at that time was former Governor Arne Carlson, who actually was my seatmate, and myself. And we were kind of just representative of that group, if you will, that was the majority of the party at the time. He was even not only moderate Republican, but he was less political than most. And so the legislature didn't have the sharp edges that it does today. And even at that time, his edges were less sharp than others. So he made an interesting choice as a compromise moderate candidate for Speaker of the House.
Did that help when you had an evenly split House then, Republican and Democrat?
You know, it helps. It actually was essential because that's a particularly difficult role to play. And the way the structure was fashioned to get an agreement, Rod became Speaker, and then the Democrats took three major committees, the Rules Committee, the Tax Committee, chairs, and the Appropriations Committee. And then the Republicans were the subcommittee heads or the division heads in each of those committees. And Rod actually had come out of the Appropriations Committee. That was kind of his major workload. And he was on the Education Division of the Appropriations Committee. The Appropriations Committee itself, by its very nature, was less political because what you're trying to do is allocate funds to various state needs. The more political was how many funds do you raise, which was the Tax Committee's role. And it would have been more difficult to select a compromise leader who is coming out of the more partisan Tax Committee.
I always thought that Speaker Searle was a very charming man, very smart guy, too. How did his charm and wit help under a divided House?
You know, I think those are characteristics which led to his election as Speaker of the House, because you had to bring groups together, and, you know, humor always helps in that. He wasn't a big humorist. You know, he's kind of a economically conservative. He was out of a farm community, although Owatonna was more a, you know, one of Minnesota's mid-sized towns, so he did have that urban influence. And then he grew up in New Jersey, or at least he grew partially up in New Jersey, so he had a little different frame of reference. I think all of those things helped. In addition, he didn't get his bachelor's degree till well into his adulthood, and I think that made him both very interested in education, and it made him very modest, because he, you know, wasn't bringing a big Harvard degree or a PhD into his role that he could write as, you know, I'm credentialed, therefore my opinion has more weight. I think he really felt that he had to support his opinions with argument, and he had to be a learner, which is really important in the legislature, is to learn your job as opposed to just come in and announce your positions.
Well, Jim Uhland, I appreciate the conversation. Thanks for looking back at the life of Rod Searle.
You're welcome, Kathy, and I just think he was a model legislator, and, you know, would that we had more of them.
And Kathy Werzer for us there on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Wild rice, the iconic grain that grows across much of the northern half of the state, is at the center of a contentious debate over mining and the environment. A 40-year-old state law limits how much of mining byproduct called sulfate can be discharged into wild rice-producing waters. Prompted by mining industry concerns the standard is too strict, the state has been giving it another look and releases results of its 2-year study today. Dan Crocker reports.
On Perch Lake, on the Fond du Lac Indian Reservation west of Duluth, the wild rice grew so thick this past September that canoeists harvesting the grain completely disappeared as they pushed through the stands.
This is usually considered the best place on the reservation.
Jim Northrup has been harvesting wild rice here for over half a century. Called Manomin in Ojibwe, Northrup says it's a gift from the Creator. Sitting next to a crackling campfire, he says it's what led his people to first settle here.
The old story said that we would move west until we came to a spot where food grew on the water, and that perfectly describes Manomin. It's become our identity now. It's who we are.
Wild rice is now part of all of Minnesota's identity. It's even the official state grain. The plant's significance helped lead to a 1973 state law to protect it from sulfate pollution. The law limits sulfate discharges into wild rice-producing waters to 10 milligrams per liter. It's based on research done in the 1930s and 40s that found that no large wild rice stands grew in waters high in sulfate. The standard went largely unenforced until 2010, when the MPCA began to ask mining companies to document wild rice plants in lakes and streams where they discharge wastewater. But mining companies questioned the science behind the standard. In 2010, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce sued to overturn the standard, although the case was eventually dismissed by the courts. Bills were introduced to weaken it. In the end, lawmakers set aside $1.5 million for a 2-year study to determine whether the standard is scientifically valid. It's those results that will be released later today.
The study actually relies on multiple lines of investigations.
Shannon Lothammer is overseeing the study for the MPCA. She says scientists have gathered more field data from northern Minnesota, and they've conducted experiments on wild rice plants in glass jars in the lab and in plants grown outside in plastic tubs to try to learn exactly what effect sulfate has on the plants. Today's results should provide more clarity, but Lothammer says it will take the PCA until the end of February to answer the question everyone's waiting for.
Do we believe that there's a reason to support, a scientific basis to support a change to the standard? And if so, does it look like the standard should be higher or lower based on this new information?
The PCA's decision is sure to be highly scrutinized. Frank Ongaro is executive director of Minnesota Mining, an industry group that represents copper-nickel mines like PolyMet, currently under environmental review.
We just believe that a standard should be based on science and that companies shouldn't be required to invest maybe hundreds of millions of dollars until we have science backing up whatever the appropriate sulfate level is for a standard to protect wild rice.
Supporters of the law argue it is based on sound science. Paula Maccabee with the group Water Legacy says under the Clean Water Act, the burden of proof is on the MPCA to show scientific proof before changing the standard.
I think that's what we're counting on, is that our laws don't make it easy for political pressure to weaken water quality standards.
The MPCA will analyze study results for the next 2 months. In April, the agency will begin a rulemaking process to address any recommended changes to the wild rice standard and to designate which waters are subject to the sulfate limits.
Dan Crocker on the Fond du Lac Reservation. The state's newest renewable power plant is starting operations in Le Sueur. The power is generated as vegetable waste and animal waste is broken down and fermented. That process creates methane that will fuel generators. Some residents in the southern Minnesota city who oppose the plant now question whether it's worth the price tag. Mark Stile is here with a report.
Avant Energy Vice President Kelsey Dillon leads the way through a maze of storage tanks, ductwork, and pipes in the new plant.
We're going to cut through this way.
When she gets to the far side of the building, Dillon opens an outside door and points to the heart of the energy operation.
These two tanks here are the digesters. Each of these is about 1.6 million gallons.
The digester tanks hold a slurry of corn silage and cow manure. Tiny organisms called methanogens feed on the material and turn it into methane gas. The gas is used to fuel for electricity generators. Dillon says the plant is still going through its startup phase and should be at full production in 2 or 3 months.
Today we're probably at about a third of the capacity.
The facility will send its 8 megawatts of electricity directly to the city of Le Sueur's distribution system. The bioenergy plant is owned by the Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, a collective of a dozen Minnesota communities serving about 70,000 customers. Avant Energy manages the system. Kelsey Dillon says the Le Sueur project is the largest anaerobic digester to electricity facility in the state. Most of the other digesters in Minnesota are on-farm systems that turn manure into methane gas. Dillon says although the plant is operating as expected now, there were some unexpected problems on the road to completion.
The biggest challenge with this project is that it's new to the region. There's a lot of history with anaerobic digestion facilities in Europe, but when it comes to contractors and engineers and vendors in the U.S., people aren't as familiar with it.
Dillon says that unfamiliarity led developers to underestimate the cost of the project. The initial construction estimate was $30 million, but the final price tag is about 50% higher, close to $45 million. That's provided an opening for skeptics. Le Sueur City Council member John Schultz says he's been criticized as having a bad attitude for his persistent questioning of the bioenergy project. At one point, he and others in town tried to force a referendum on whether the plant should be built.
We did a petition 14 months ago to have an election in our town about this event. We had 645 signatures, which is more than 25% of our election turnout in our last general election.
City officials challenged the petition, and the whole thing ended up in court where a judge ruled against holding a special election on the bioenergy plant. Schultz and others were concerned that the plant might cause excessive odor and truck traffic problems, among other things. Schultz also questioned the sharp rise in the construction cost.
I wish I would know, but once again, until we have transparency, we'll never know what's going on within that project.
A big reason Avant Energy hasn't released detailed information on the cost increase is because they don't have to under state law. For the most part, municipal energy companies are not regulated by the Public Utilities Commission or any other state body. They're not required to have an open bidding process where project costs would be revealed to the public. They also set their own electric rates. Mike Bull with the Minneapolis-based Center for Energy and Environment says the rationale behind the law is that state supervision is unneeded because another public body is already doing that.
Because municipal utilities are effectively regulated by their city councils, they are not subject to state regulation.
There is one area of state oversight. City utility companies are required to meet Minnesota's renewable energy mandate. By 2016, the Minnesota Municipal Power Agency must acquire 17% of its electricity from renewable sources. The Le Sueur Bioenergy Plant is a step in that direction.
Mark Steil there in Le Sueur. DFL State Senator Matt Schmidt of Red Wing kicked off a 10-city border-to-border broadband tour today. He's trying to promote wider availability of high-speed internet access. Elizabeth Baer reports.
Schmidt says the state is falling short on providing broadband service to all parts of Minnesota. He calls high-speed internet access an essential 21st-century utility. Schmidt held a similar tour in the fall to learn more about the need for reliable, high-speed internet across the state. He says the state also needs to update its policy framework.
We have laws on the books that are over 100 years old, and they have no applicability to the 21st century realities in telecommunications law. So I think that we can take a good look at antiquated laws in telecommunications and broadband service.
Schmidt will talk about efforts to expand the service at the tour's first session today in North Branch. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News, Rochester.
And that's it for the NPR News Update for Monday the 6th. Join me again tomorrow for Tuesday's news.